This is Ian Hunter, and you're listening to the Run to the Top podcast.
Hello, everyone. This is Coach Claire Barthalic, the Planted Runner, and welcome to the Run to the Top. Today's interview is one that you don't want to miss with biomechanist Dr. Ian Hunter. Ian is an expert on how the body moves while running. So if you have ever wondered if you were running as efficiently as possible, or if you could fix your form, which is just about all of us, this is the episode for you. Dr. Hunter not only teaches biomechanics at Brigham Young University, but he is part of a research team that helped determine just how much the controversial Nike Vaporfly 4% really help you run faster. Hint, it's not always 4%. And his test subject was none other than Jared Ward, the American Olympic marathoner headed to London on October 4th, who I interviewed just a few weeks ago. So yeah, it's safe to say Ian knows a whole lot more than the rest of us about running shoes and how we perform in them. I ask him all about not only the Nikes, but all types of shoes, how to know which ones to choose, and how we can run faster. Before we get to the interview, I want to say thank you so much to everyone who is supporting my personal mission to get 1,000 iTunes reviews by the end of 2020. Reviews don't always show up immediately after you post them, but y'all are stepping up to the plate. I'd like to specifically shout out Daddy Ogre, Sheerwoman, AVGGD, and 610 Super Tanker for their reviews this week. I also know that Sabina, David, John, Marie, Mike, Christine, Carlos, and many more took the time to write a little something-something, and I really, really appreciate it. What about you? Can you spare a minute and give a review? The quicker that we can get to 1,000, the fewer times I need to ask you, and we can just get right into the show. I'm guilty of loving podcasts and not leaving reviews myself, so I know how it is. But with over 4.8 million downloads, we really need to boost our reviews for the Run to the Top. Why are reviews so important? Well, because when you are scrolling through new shows to listen to, reviews tell people that our show is worth listening to. It shows that we have a dedicated audience that is willing to take 2 minutes to announce to the world that, hey, this is a great show and you should listen to it too. Not only does it help us get new listeners, but it helps us get better guests that make the show even better for you. Even if you're not an Apple user, you can still leave an iTunes review by creating an account. Yes, I know that's a little bit of a pain, but if you go to all that trouble and leave a review, send me a screenshot to claire@runnersconnect.net, and I will not only give you some big love on the show, but I will personally answer your running and training questions free of charge. One commenter in our Facebook group suggested that we create a contest for those who leave a review. What do you think? Let me know, along with your screenshot, at claire@runnersconnect.net, and we'll come up with something awesome. If you're wondering where all of our other daily episodes have gone to, we've put them all over at the Run to the Top Extra Kick podcast. All of the Runners Connect coaches take turns bringing you a buffet of running knowledge in shorter daily episodes so that you can become a better runner on the go. So to avoid missing even a single episode, please subscribe to both the Extra Kick and the Run to the Top. Now let's get right into my interview with biomechanist, Dr. Ian Hunter. Welcome to the Run to the Top, Ian.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
You research and teach about sports biomechanics at Brigham Young University. Can you first define for us what exactly that is and how you became interested in it?
Yeah. Biomechanics is the study of forces and how they affect living systems. That's the textbook format of it. Basically, it's a physics class based upon, for us, human motion. And my focus is mainly on running because that is what I enjoyed as I grew up and went through college myself.
Okay, so you were a college runner?
Yes, I was a middle distance runner.
And how were your biomechanics?
Well, they served me well, and there were definitely imperfections, but you don't really know until it's too late, usually, what you should have done. You realize later on in life.
Yeah, you mean after you get injured?
Yeah, mostly that's the issue. For distance running, something off with biomechanics is often leads to an injury.
Would you say that athletes that do understand their particular biomechanics will be able to perform their best?
Yes, but with that said, the human body is incredible at figuring it out without mm-hmm. necessarily needing a coach and so on, at least for distance running. If there's a certain stress or high pressure in a certain part of the body, our body adapts to it. And a coach might not have seen that. So I'd say trust the body first, but then take into account your own thoughts and coach's thoughts to help guide some potential changes.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit more about running mechanics. There doesn't seem to be a perfect running form as much as we would like there to be. You look at top level athletes and how they run, and they don't all run the same. And they're still obviously really successful. So can you improve your running mechanics and therefore perform better?
I believe you can, but it's not as simple as change this foot strike or start taking a longer or shorter stride. What it takes is changing your body so that it comes to feel right about those new mechanics. So if we have someone that we feel could benefit from, let's say, a modified swinging the leg through while the foot is in the air. You know, you see some people that have their foot kick out to the side or some things that seem unusual to us. There's a reason it's happening. And one like that would often be a specific muscle group around the hips that is not quite doing its job right. So rather than saying, change this in your movement, we'd figure out where this strength deficiency is, work on that, and then hopefully the mechanics would take care of themselves.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about foot strike. Everybody asks, is there a proper way to hit the ground, and heel striking is bad and forefoot striking is good. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I've thought about that a lot over the years. Back in, I think it was the 70s, might have been Montreal Olympics, where there was a project done that looked at foot strike among these elite athletes and cadence and a few things. And they noticed these really fast runners are having a cadence of around 180 steps per minute and were mostly landing midfoot strike. And so they thought, there's the right way to run. And that idea lingers today still. If you get online and look up foot strike or stride rate in running, you'll see this number 180. And when we've tested these and when other labs have looked a lot at foot strike, we've found not everyone does 180, even the true elite runners. And not everyone is a midfoot striker. Most are if they're running really quickly, like was observed. But you take those same runners and get them running at, say, a 7-minute mile pace or 8-minute mile pace, you notice most of them are heel strikers, and they're doing a cadence much lower than 180. When we force people away from their preferred cadence, even if, let's say, their preferred cadence is 170 steps a minute, and we put them at 180, they use more energy to run. Mm-hmm. So we've seen in our own measurements and a few other labs around the country that if you change the preferred running mechanics, whether it's foot strike or stride length, stride rate, then energy cost of running goes up. You're also putting different pressures on the body that aren't adapted to it yet. And so you also increase the risk of injury if you just start changing to look like somebody else.
Right. And obviously runners come in all shapes and sizes. Taller runners are going to have a different cadence than shorter right. runners. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the average might be 180. That's great. But if you have a very powerful athlete with long legs, then they're probably going to be more closer to 170, at least at a certain speed, where the average is 180. So mm-hmm. we've got to take into account everything about the person to really know what the right choices are on any potential technique changes.
Right. Well, what about an athlete that continues to be injured and is, you know, you look at their something about their form. How do you make changes in a form because they really are getting injured from their preferred way of running?
Yeah. So let me share the differences between, say, a midfoot strike runner and a heel strike runner. And this example will give a good connection to that question. A midfoot striker is going to spend a little bit less time on the ground. They'll have a shorter, more rapid stride, and they'll have a smaller amount of force. The peak force from the ground back onto the body is about 4% less with a midfoot striker. And so we might think, oh, that's good, right? Less force, less impact on the body, less injury. But if they go the same distance, they've done more repetitions also. And so it kind of balances out that when we look at the collection of studies on foot strike, we find the same incidence of injury, total numbers of injuries among midfoot and heel strikers. But the locations of those injuries tends to be below the knee for a midfoot striker and knee and above for a heel striker. Now, a heel striker can get a foot injury, but the tendency is different locations for the same amount of total injuries. So when someone has, let's say we have a heel striker that's having a lot of hip trouble, then I'll often recommend, let's get you on a soft surface. Like I really like a nice turf field rather than grass. That tends to often have a lot of bumpiness to it, but at least a soft surface, go a little slower, drop the mileage a little, and try landing more midfoot. And that should take some stress off the hip. We don't do it on a hard surface because we're going to add some stress to areas below the knee. So a soft surface, a little bit slower, back off on the training a little, but you may be able to train through an injury, get it healed by modifying form. Once everything's finished with the injury, then they'll probably return to their preferred heel striking again, but with the injury healed and a gradual progression, they can hopefully just continue on from there.
Okay. Well, so they wouldn't, I would think that if they practice through the injury, you know, changing their foot strike, that they would eventually learn to prefer that foot strike, but you don't see that happening?
I know of some cases where that's been the occurrence. I only have a 2-week example for myself where I had a really bad heel blister. And I had to keep training because that's how we feel. You just feel you have to. Mm-hmm. So I kept training, and on my left foot, and actually both, it's hard to do one without the other. So mm-hmm. I was landing midfoot for 2 weeks straight. And when the blister was healed enough that I could land on my heel again, it felt so good to return to that. It never felt comfortable midfoot striking. My expectation is it's due to the anatomy and structure of the foot and ankle, and that is not something that's easy to change.
Sure. Sure. You kind of get used to running a certain way that's right for your own body, and that's hard to fix, right? So should we as coaches even bother trying to change people's form?
Generally, I would say no, with the exception of especially someone that's a beginning runner that wants to commit to doing this for years and decades beyond, where there'll be some imperfections in their running technique when they start, but it's probably not because they don't know how to run. We all know how to run from the time we're, at least by 3 years old,
right.
Probably as a 2-year-old, we're going to be running. So we know how to do it, but there's going to be some weaknesses because it's not something people are generally accustomed to in terms of training, like we might say. So as someone starts running, the body will gradually become stronger in those weaker areas that weren't used to running. And the technique will typically take care of itself.
Okay. Okay. Well, the most common reasons we think about changing our form is, first of all, injury prevention. And second of all, speed and efficiency. We want to become faster runners over longer distances.
Right.
So you say that it's just more about practicing running that'll become a better runner rather than changing our form.
Yeah, for biomechanics mm-hmm. and for the physiology. The body's really good at figuring things out for what we'd say economy of running. Mm-hmm. If we're going to carry a heavy bag of groceries for a mile, we learn how to position our arm to make that effective and not so challenging. And with just about any human activity you can think of, the body realizes, here's a way that I can do this with less energy cost to me. And running is included there, where if you just let it happen, that's the technique that will use the least energy.
Okay, great, great. Well, what about outside of running? Surely you recommend strength training and physical therapy and all of that sort of thing. What sort of things should we runners be doing outside of the run?
I definitely would include strength training. It becomes a challenge, though. Let's say that you're not a professional athlete. You've got time commitments. Mm-hmm. You've got probably a job, you've got family time, there's all kinds of things going on in life. And so ideally, if you want to be a really good runner, you'll be putting the mileage in, gradually building the training over time. You'll be spending probably a couple of days at least in the weight room, especially working on muscles that have certain weaknesses that are developed through running that are not necessarily developed through other activities we might do.
Such as what?
I like a lot of the lower body being things like squats and cleans. In running, you're landing, the muscle lengthens while it's active and then shortens while it's active. We call that eccentric and then concentric muscle activation. So just doing things like slow leg curls and so on have some benefit, but not as much as something like a clean, if everyone mm-hmm. knows what that is. Lifting the bar, there's a bit of a almost jumping involved where you're doing that explosive kind of nature, but with larger forces than you're doing in running typically. So anything that's like those Olympic type lifts are going to be great. And then I like to just tell people any muscle that attaches to your pelvis needs to become very strong. So a lot of the core exercises and so on will help with keeping everything sturdy and in place and good hip position. And that's often where the weaknesses are that aren't developed with normal everyday life activities. So core strengthening, and then anything that has you going through flexion and extension at the hip and knee with a pretty quick explosive kind of force.
Okay, that sounds good. And any tips for the knees? You just mentioned the knees. So many runners have some knee issues. Any tips for that?
It really depends what the knee issue is.
Okay.
If there's some cartilage degradation over time, that's going to become a real issue. Some encouraging news comes from one of my colleagues that studies osteoarthritis of the knee. And he did a cross-sectional study looking at runners versus non-runners and found running, if it's done in a way that you don't make big training mistakes, it's actually very good for your cartilage and knees.
Good.
So if you are smart in your training or have a good coach that's wise, then you won't be making rapid training mistakes where an injury could occur. And cartilage, just like any other tissue in the body, does adapt and get stronger. It's just slow at it because there's not much blood flow. So things like cartilage on the knees, running is actually going to be very healthy for it.
Good.
If it's a tendonitis, then that's one where long term it shouldn't be an issue, but we just have to back off, do some repetitive strength training during that time to get the tissue stronger. And then something like a tendonitis around the knee can be healed and you can be fine long term with that kind of an issue.
Okay, good to know. Good to know. One of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show is I recently had Olympian Jared Ward on, and I was talking to him about how you and he and a team of researchers set out to determine how much Nike's Vaporfly 4% really helped improve performance. Can you tell us a little bit about that study?
Yeah. The study originally happened with the University of Colorado, and they found that 4% difference that the shoe's named after. And one of those researchers called me and said, "We're having a hard time publishing this because he's a consultant for Nike, so there could be some bias." But he was so confident in the results. And when I said, "Is it really 4%? That sounds unbelievable for a shoe change to make that much of a difference." And it's someone that I have respected for decades. And he said, "Yeah, it really is." So I thought, okay, we'll replicate the study and see if we can publish it also, and added a couple other measures to make it unique from what they did. Jared is very good at statistics, has a master's degree in statistics, yes, and teaches a couple courses at BYU with that. So got him on board with it, and we got through the study. We only found 2.9%. But
still significant.
Still, that's enough to care about. Now, we learned that does not mean you're going to be 2.9 or 4% faster. That's just the energy use. It allows us to run faster, but it's more like a 1 to maybe 2% increase in performance, but a lot less energy used and quicker recoveries from wearing those shoes. So it turned out to be a great benefit. We did find that some people do not benefit from the Vaporfly compared to traditional shoes. We had anyone benefiting from 0 up to 6.2%, and the average was at 2.9.
Okay. What were the differences in the people who were at each end of the bell curve?
The only measurement we found that indicated what's going on there was the amount of time someone spends on the ground. So we call it ground contact time. And at the speed we were doing, those that spent less time on the ground gained a greater benefit from the Vaporfly shoe.
Okay.
And we think it's something to do with the stiffness of the foam. As it gets compressed and then extends, it stores and releases energy. And it's going to have a preferred timing of how it does that.
Okay.
So the idea is, those running at the same speed that spend less time on the ground will have the energy return from the shoe happening at the right time, and then they get a greater benefit.
Interesting. And this is not the same thing as cadence. Is that correct?
Well, they're related. If you have a fixed speed, then stride length multiplied by stride rate will equal the speed. So
they're,
if one goes up, the other goes down.
Gotcha. And so your study, the results from your study have obviously been used to help other companies compete with Nike. Is that correct?
Yes. A fun story with Jared. Before the New York Marathon 2 years ago, he was planning on wearing the Saucony Kinvara, and some prototype shoes showed up on Monday, three pairs of them with different types of foam. And the workout before the marathon on the Wednesday before was 4 times a mile at race pace, which for him is under 5-minute mile. So we did it on the treadmill while measuring oxygen uptake, which tells us how much energy he's using. And we started with the Kinvara and then two of the prototypes, and his energy cost was, I forget the exact numbers, so I won't bother saying them, but was constant through those three shoes. And then we put on the last prototype, and all of a sudden, he was using 3% less energy.
Okay.
And I waited till it was all done so I wouldn't excite him and change his energy cost, and said, "Jared, I think we know what shoe you should consider for New York Marathon." And he likes data, so we looked at the data and found there's the shoe that's going to use the least energy. And in that race, he was the first American just by 6 seconds. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference between a $25,000 bonus and a $15,000.
Yeah.
So for a while, we were calling, "These are your $10,000 shoes." That's how much we imagine if you save 3% energy, then it's, well, he may not have had that 6-second lead at the end of the day.
Sure. And those eventually were the endorphin pros. Is that correct?
Right. So that's the same. Actually, that's not the same foam. That was the best one at the time. There were a few more prototypes, and there were two methods for creating the foam. You've seen the pebbled foam that some shoes have, and there's a more solid looking foam. We found that the pebbled foam seemed to be doing a little bit better, but the lower density of the solid foam was a bigger benefit than that. And they found a way to create the pebbled foam with the low density of the other, and that's what became the Endorphin Pro.
Okay. So it's more than just the carbon plate. It's the foam that does the work, or combination, you think?
I believe it's mainly the foam. The plate is not, they talk about it being a spring, but it follows the length of the shoe. It's not directed in a way that it's going to bounce us off the ground. But with the thickness of the foam, especially if you turn a sharp corner in those, you feel like the shoe might collapse on you. Mm-hmm. And the foam or the plate gives some integrity to that foam so that it maintains its shape a little more effectively. The plate we did a study with where we took the Saucony Freedom shoe, which is just a lightweight training shoe with very little support to it. And we put varying degrees of stiffnesses of carbon fiber inside those. And we did find that a moderate amount of stiffness does seem to help a bit with metabolic cost, but not anywhere near the 3 or 4% that we're seeing from the other studies with the foam added to it.
Okay, good to know. And, you know, I know that the foam, they have made some rules on the stack height of the shoe. Yeah. Can you talk about what that is all about, why a higher shoe would increase performance?
Yeah, well, we know there'll be an optimal height of shoe, right? Higher is not always better, but it seems that going to 40 millimeters was really beneficial. It's going to be the combination of how thick the midsole is and the construction of the foam. If we go too thick, we become unstable. And if it's low density foam, then getting too high will become a big issue at some point. So if you can choose the right foam, you might be able to get the same benefit while having it not be 40 millimeters. Maybe we'll find 28 millimeters ends up being optimal if it's a certain property of foam. So the height gets a lot of attention, but that's just a piece of what matters with the foam.
Interesting. You did mention at the beginning that you saw that there were the better recovery when wearing those shoes. Were you able to test that, like how a racer feels after the marathon?
No. Okay. It's a challenging thing to test, but Nike did do a presentation on that at a conference I went to, where they did do some measurements on muscle damage, and we're finding there's a meaningful, not enormous, but there is a meaningful difference in the damage to the muscles specifically when wearing this new style of racing shoe.
And is that simply because the foam absorbs some of the shock, or did any reason why?
Yes. Yeah. So when in the Vaporfly and in the Endorphin Pro, we've seen about 4% lower peak force on the body. The foot ends up on the ground a little bit longer with a smaller amount of force. And the combination of those two, that we call it impulse, force multiplied by time, is actually larger, and you get a longer stride without doing any extra effort. So there's, less force on the body, I think, is the key there. We're not getting such a shock to the muscles at the impact with the ground.
Yeah, definitely anecdotally, people are reporting this. I ran a marathon in the Nikes, and I I mean, I definitely felt that I'd gone on a long run, but not the same kind of damage that you feel where you can't walk for 2 days afterwards.
Yeah.
So I definitely noticed that.
Yeah.
So speaking of shoes, you've done a lot of research on shoes, from barefoot shoes, minimalist shoes, spikes, all of that. Can you explain how our choice of shoes affects our performance overall?
Yeah. Each run is going to have its specific purpose. And so I remember looking for a minimalist shoe at a local running store here to use for a study. And when I chosen the one we wanted for that, I said, hey, can I try on a pair of those Hokas, the Hoka Bondi, which is the thickest one? Mm-hmm. Because I'd been telling people, those are so tall, you step on a rock, you're going to break your ankle. It's silly. Don't try that shoe. And I took one step of running in that shoe and thought, oh, I want a pair of these. And I learned from that and other experiences, let's say you've got the morning after a really hard workout and you've got a little recovery morning run to do. Lower legs and feet maybe feel a little bit beat up and tight. Being able to run with a soft surface created by a shoe, the one like that Hoka Bondi, I think it's a great choice. It has its purpose of a great recovery day shoe, where you're taking a little bit of stress off some areas that got damaged. If we want performance on the road, then this, now I can just call it a new style of racing shoe, because most of the companies now have some version of a thicker, low density foam shoe. That's what we're going to perform best in on the roads. With the track, we're not allowed that same 40 millimeter. Depends on the race, actually, but for distance racing, it's around 25 millimeters or less, but you've got the cushioning of the track and you need some traction, so adding a spike plate to it. If it's just the regular getting your runs in kind of thing, then the traditional trainer is what I prefer for those days. And then barefoot and minimalist does have a good effect on building strength of the bones and the little muscles inside the foot. So I like to say, well, why are you going on this run? And if they have a good answer for that, then I can suggest here's the appropriate shoe for that purpose.
Okay, great. So definitely you should have a quiver of shoes in your closet.
Yeah, yeah. I usually work through about three different shoes. I do have a Hoka for that recovery day. I've got my Endorphins for my racing and fast workouts, and then I wear a Nike Pegasus most of the time for my just regular running days. And it often gets missed, especially in the winter, but I do try to do at least a warm up or cool down on the grass barefoot for a bit of foot strengthening.
Okay, great. And how often should you change your shoes? When do you know when to toss them away or donate them? Any advice on that?
That's hard. My son seems to think you need to replace them every month. If he gets a little foot pain, he thinks, oh, it's because of the shoes. Typically, I end up doing somewhere around 400 or 500 miles in a pair of trainers. These lower density foam shoes, I don't think have that same energy return, and you care about it more in those shoes because you want optimal performance on the day. So those ones, I tend to try to go more like a couple hundred miles. The pros will do one race in those and then swap them out.
Sure.
So it comes down to money. But in terms of injury, I think if we're getting over 500 miles for most people, that midsole is starting to get pretty worn out and beat up and isn't going to be as soft and protective of the foot.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, what are you researching now, and what questions are you looking to get answered in the future?
Yeah, that's a good question. Right now, because of Jared's New York Marathon that has the hills as you go over a few bridges, he said he didn't feel that his shoe was as effective on the uphill compared to the downhill. So we're replicating what we did with that Vaporfly study, looking at energy cost comparing between shoes. We're doing it with the Endorphin Pro and the Taipei from Saucony. That's their traditional marathon racing shoe. But we're doing uphill, level, and downhill running to see, let's say it's 3% difference on level. Maybe it's only 2% uphill and maybe it's 4% downhill. So we've only got 5 out of 18 people tested so far, so we don't really have any results to share yet. But that'll let us know, do the shoes work just as well uphill, downhill level, or are they, do they have some weaknesses on certain conditions? And if there is a weakness, try to figure out what can we do to make some improvements there. So that's the current study we're actively collecting data on now. The next one we're going into is that not actually with footwear, but that piqued some interest on uphill running. And we've noticed as we've collected data in our current study, some people use lower energy on the uphill condition than the downhill, and some are the opposite way around. So we're going to measure the energy cost of running for various grades, along with everything we can about the running mechanics of the person, to find out, here's the type of runner. Maybe someone with a long stride struggles on the uphill. That's at least been anecdotal over the years, but we found there's not actually a study that's measured those things to find out.
Interesting.
So the lab I'm working in and my students with me there, our focus is all on running performance. So it's not all just footwear. That became an exciting thing the last few years. And we'll continue some of that, but we're also wanting to know what can we do to make people perform better in terms of the mechanics of running and the footwear.
Okay. Well, I think most people know if they are good uphill runners and good downhill runners, right? Yeah.
But so, can we improve it somehow, either through technique or through some different conditioning, maybe some strength training that'll get them a better... Uphill running uses a lot of concentric muscle activity.
Right.
So maybe there's some differences in training that can help someone that struggles with that to be better at it.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be great, especially, you know, if you're training for a hilly race or, you know, you're training for something like Boston that has a lot of downhill, you know, how do you prepare for that? So that would be, I mean, do we have different mechanics on uphill and downhill, most people?
We do, for sure.
Yeah.
There'll definitely be a little bit different of a lean of the body. Mm-hmm. We're always going to have a shorter stride uphill because we're moving slower, but also the ground arrives a little bit earlier. The foot strikes are different between uphill and downhill. So there's quite a few differences. And I think that's why one person is better at it than another, because of their natural technique that they like to feel.
Great. Well, looking forward to hearing what you come up with in those studies. I think we're getting into the home stretch here. So I have a few questions that I ask everyone. Okay. If you could go back and talk to yourself when you first started running, what advice would you give yourself?
The number one thing would definitely be it's the people that matter. Mm-hmm. You get connected with training partners and coaches and even competitors that can often end up being lifelong friends. But let's say you're going out on runs with people. I realized that outside of my own family, I spend much more time, hours more a week with my running friends than anyone else that I work with or whatever activities are going on. And most of the time is not talking about running. We're out there just visiting about, oh, what's going on in life? And I have 4 children. They're all 1 in high school, 3 in college, 2 of them are married. And there's a lot of questions that come with a parent, things to think about when someone says, I think I want to marry this person. And so it's just random life things, life events going on that you're very open and honest and conversing with people. So as much as performance times and PRs are exciting, the thing that really matters after decades of doing this is who are you associated with? And those connections are what I think are, you know, years ago, it would be make sure you don't focus just on performance. Focus on the people you're doing it with.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And what is the greatest gift running has given you?
Experiences, for sure. And I'd obviously include the relationships I've received through it, but because of some performances I've done, there's been opportunities to travel internationally and stay with some host families for a race and things like that. And getting out and learning about the world and the cultures that are out there, learning respect for other people, nationalities, cultures, and all that is something that running has opened up quite a few doors for me for. And that's been a real high value to my life.
Great, great. Well, and speaking of international running, any predictions for the London Marathon coming up October 4th?
Yes, Jared's going to win it. we did our what we call PMP run this morning, predicted marathon pace, 8 miles. I did part of it and not at the same pace as Jared, but he was able to go right under 208 marathon pace for 8 miles. And here we are up at 4,600 feet. So he seems primed, ready for a good performance. Exactly where that'll place him out of a field of 50 elite runners is really hard to predict. We often joke about, well, how long will it be if you're able to hold off Kipchoge and not get lapped? That would be a pretty successful day.
Absolutely.
I don't want to exclude Bekele in that conversation either.
Right.
They'll both do amazing. Yeah. But a really good day would be if Jared can get a PR. You know, he did that in Boston at 209.25, I believe it was. This London course was designed initially as the sub-2 attempt that was done in England. So it's designed for speed. There's going to be some great competition to bring him along to a PR is kind of the goal. His fitness is right in place that I wouldn't be surprised if that happened. But in the marathon, there's so many uncertainties. So
absolutely.
Let's say I'll predict 209.12.
Okay.
And Jared will be pleased if that's the outcome.
Good. Well, we're rooting for him. Yeah, it's the perfect course for a statistician. Just lots and lots of loops, right?
There'll be a big scoreboard that's going to have predicted finish times as you come by each lap. And they're doing a lot to make it an exciting event where there's not going to be many spectators, just a few coaches and agents scattered around the course.
Well, we'll definitely be watching and rooting him on. And finally, Ian, where can listeners connect with you?
I don't have any podcasts or anything I do myself, but I post a little bit on some of our research and what my kids are up to with their racing on Instagram. BYU Ian is my name on there. If you don't know BYU, it's for Brigham Young University, so you know the spelling BYU. And then my name is spelled I-A-I-N. So you could follow me on Twitter and Instagram with that. If you're interested in looking a little deeper into the research, I have a website that's biomechanics.byu.edu. And that has a little bit about my courses and so on. But there's also a menu that says track and field, where it has a little bit of other things that have been going on that may be of interest to those that are listening today.
Okay, great. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show. We learned a lot. So many of our listeners really love to get into the nuts and bolts and the data. So I'm sure that lots of people are going to be listening to this show. I really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate you having me.
So is that what you were expecting? If you want to boil it all down, Dr. Hunter's advice is to choose the right shoe for the run you are doing and don't really try to fix your form. The body is amazingly adaptable for running at what it thinks is the most efficient way. And when we try to fix things, we can often make things less efficient. Sometimes we think it would be easier if the experts would just say, do this, put your arms here, lean this way, and run this many steps per minute. And we will somehow run smoother and faster than ever. But unfortunately, that's really not how it works. Run more and you will get better at running. That's basically it. Sure, you need to mix up the hard days and the easy days and run different speeds sometimes and don't increase your mileage too quickly and rest well and all of that. But overall, your body will figure it out if you run often enough. Shoes do matter, and this conversation is a good reminder that you shouldn't get too attached to one shoe for every single run. Just like you would wear different clothes to go to the grocery store or go to your high school reunion, you should wear different shoes for different running occasions. Thank you once again for listening to the Run to the Top this week. I'm Coach Claire Barthalik, the Planted Runner. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, my goal for the rest of 2020 is to get 1,000 reviews on iTunes. It just takes a minute, and I really need your help. So let's make this happen together. Another way you can reach out is to join the fun in our Facebook group, Runners Connect Winner's Circle. We coaches are over there talking about everything running, and we'd love to know what you think. Have a great run today.
Thanks for listening to the Run to the Top podcast from runnersconnect.net.